Hello, everyone. My name is Sari McCree. I'm Vice President of Corporate Relations for Allstate Corporation. First, let me thank the Aspen Institute and the Atlantic for pulling this session together today. Allstate is involved in the Aspen Ideas Festival because we believe exploring the American experience makes us better citizens and makes for a better country. Today's session is going to talk about one of the most interesting citizens in the last century of America. Who really was Richard Nixon? It's a fascinating question and one that the subject himself might not have been able to answer. Fortunately, with us today, we have an author and commentator who knows the ex-president maybe perhaps better than he knew himself. Elizabeth Drew was Washington correspondent at the New Yorker for 19 years. She has written several books, including one on Mr. Nixon. She has served as a moderator and panelist for presidential debates. She writes a syndicated national column and is a regular contributor to New York Review of Books. Elizabeth Drew knows Washington, and today she'll tell us what she knows about one of its most enigmatic inhabitants. Now, before I turn it over to Ms. Drew, I wanted to let you know that at 1 o'clock, she'll be signing books here in this room. So we're very glad to welcome Elizabeth Drew. Thank you.
Thank you, sorry. Is the mic working? No? Mike?
Please forgive me.
I will talk until someone comes and fixes it. There's a fair amount of noise, so that may be why you're not hearing the mic. I am a long time, if not recent, aficionado of the Aspen Institute. I re-met here in 1979 a Brit whom I ended up marrying. We had to check that it wasn't just the altitude, but it wasn't, and we were very happily married for 22 years, upon which, alas, he died of heart failure. So I have a very sentimental attachment to Aspen. And thank you, everybody, for coming. It's quite an honor that you're here. I want to get right to it. The two questions I am usually asked when I have a radio or television interview on this book, the book came out on the 1st of June, so I've been doing a lot of talk about it, but given the august group here, I rethought what it was I wanted to say. And the first question is, why did you want to write a book about Richard Nixon? And the answer is, I didn't. I had published 13 books, and I'd sworn off writing books. They pin you down, they isolate you, the publishers drive you crazy. And my real passion is reporting on and understanding what is going on at the current time and trying to explain this to whoever will read it. But when this book is part of a very distinguished series of short books on presidents. It was the brainstorm of the late and extremely lamented Arthur Schlesinger, who got the brilliant idea that there should be short, accessible books on each president. And I had actually purchased some of the books. Most of them are by very, very distinguished historians. For instance, I purchased Gary Will's on James Madison. I was actually thinking that James Madison is the founder, kind of least celebrated in books. And when I read Gary's short book, I realized why. He's a very boring man. A deity at the Constitutional Convention and all through the Watergate impeachment hearings and discussions, we talked about him all the time. But he really he was obviously a genius, but he was really not interesting and really not a very good president. So the editor of the series came to me, and I said, I'm sorry, I'm not writing any more books, and explained he was editing this series. I didn't know that. And he said, would you be interested in doing Nixon? Nobody talks about writing books anymore. You do them. Would you be interested in doing Nixon? And I just could not resist. Many people in this room more or less grew up with Nixon. My first book grew out of a series that I wrote for The New Yorker, which was a journal of the period. It wasn't just, you know, how I felt about things, but I was all over the place. I was at the battlefront, the courts, the Congress. You could even talk to the White House people in those days, amazingly enough. Some were not accessible, but a surprising number of them were. So I thought this would make, since this was really going to be my last book, it would make an interesting bookend. And the man had always fascinated me. The next question is, why another book on Nixon, which isn't wildly encouraging, but the reason is there's been a lot of books about Nixon but in the roughly generation and a half since he left office, you have to remember there's a large number of people who, probably a majority of this country, who came of age after his events and demise, don't know anything about him. And they don't know about Watergate, and they don't really know about Vietnam, and they don't really know about Nixon, yet these are huge events in our history, and they remain cautionary tales. But all these books, with one or two exceptions, are about segments of Nixon's presidency, his domestic policy, his foreign policy, and on and on. This book is about Nixon. There's Nixon and Kissinger, there's Nixon and Mao, there's Nixon, not Nixon and his dogs, because actually his dog didn't like him. He had a large Irish setter named King Timahoe, and King Timahoe didn't like Nixon, and so his aides would take to setting a trail of dog biscuits in the Oval Office up to Nixon's desk. King Timahoe wasn't biting, so to speak. So there's no Nixon and his dogs book. The assumption of the editor, I suppose, and me to some extent, was I knew an awful lot about Nixon. I had, after all, covered Watergate, and I'd covered his presidency. And that turned out to be helpful, but not very germane to this book, because those of us who covered Watergate were covering from the outside in. We didn't really know how some of these things came about. We didn't know everything that went on, and we certainly didn't know until more of the tapes came out about the conversations in the White House. Part of what I ended up thinking was that Nixon was an improbable president elected under improbable circumstances. Improbable president because he was a very peculiar man, but he was a very peculiar politician. He didn't really like people. He was virtually incapable of small talk. He was extremely introverted. He didn't like to press the flesh. In fact, he didn't like to be touched. So this was an unusual kind of person, not just to be in politics, but to rise to the heights that he did, which, by the way, never made him happy. He was not the happy warrior. And even after he became president, he wasn't happy, and he set forth on avenging all of those and there were vast numbers of them whom he considered his enemies. Now, those of us who went through it got used to certain terms and got used to certain assumptions. This book made me back off. Wait a minute. Here's a president who decides he has all these enemies. Now, we're not talking about the Soviet Union. We're not talking about people with nuclear weapons. We're talking about probably a number of people in this, could be a number of people in this room. We're talking about people who opposed him politically. We're talking about outspoken critics. We're talking about leaders of the anti-war movement. If Teal Brown is still here, we're talking about her father, Sam Brown, the leader of the moratorium. We're talking about Paul Newman, who was very vocally against the war. We're talking about university professors. We're talking about intellectuals, period. He hated intellectuals. Nixon was a very, very smart man, but he was not an intellectual, and he had no patience for it. He particularly hated, from early in his life to his death, people born to more privilege than he was. This was a real, I'm trying not to throw around psychiatric or psychological terms. I don't believe in psychobiography. But there is no way that one can understand Nixon or his presidency without getting into his head. I ran into Jim Wallace the other day, and he said he'd heard an NPR interview that I'd given. He said, he really got into your head, didn't you? And I said, that's funny you say that. I thought it was the other way around, that I got in his head, which I believe I did. So I guess it could be said that for the last 3 years or so, I had a very intimate relationship with Richard Nixon, at least as intimate as one could with such a man. And yes, I became seized with him because he's such an incredibly fascinating figure. To me, he's probably the most complex president we've ever had. And I would argue, I guess there's Thomas Jefferson and there's Abraham Lincoln and a few others, but way up there in the pantheon of our most interesting presidents. Improbable times, you have to remember, or you know, think about 1968. We had the height of the anti-war movement. We had the assassinations of Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King. This country was traumatized. King's murder, of course, set off the urban riots, and it was a time where the country was really on edge, frightened. And you can often say about elections, if only. And there are a lot of if onlys about the 1968 election, but can't go into that now. Nixon's victory over Hubert Humphrey was very narrow, and George Wallace got 14% of the vote. So there are a lot of if onlys. I'll give you one. If Lyndon Johnson had announced the bombing halt a couple of weeks earlier than October 31st, and Humphrey was gaining on Nixon when, you know, it was time for everybody to go vote. But anyway, there he was. Well, I said one has to get into Nixon's head because it's impossible to truly understand his presidency. We really lived through his psychodrama. He talked about it in many ways, but I learned this in writing the book, he met the official definition in the Manual of Psychiatric Disorders of a paranoid personality. Now again, we threw around the term paranoia. The paranoid personality is a far more serious matter. Not only does one think that one has enemies, Nixon was very inventive, let's say, in thinking up enemies. You don't trust anybody, and Nixon really didn't trust anybody, even his own staff. I would say the only person he really trusted was H.R. Perrin Bob Perrin Haldeman. And if only Nixon had known that all while they were having conversations, Haldeman was going home and keeping these meticulous notes. And actually, after Haldeman's death from cancer, out came one of the most delicious books about this whole period, The Haldeman Diaries. I'm not sure whether Haldeman knew how much he was giving away, knew how much of it, he wasn't a man with a great sense of humor, he knew how funny some of this was, but it very, very revealing. The paranoid personality not only can't confide in any way anybody, has no friends, but doesn't always make wise decisions. Well, we certainly know about that. He had no friends. And the one or two that he might have called his friends, these were not our idea of friendship. So his great friend was B.B. Rebozo, the Miami banker. And they spent enormous amount of time together, but the ground rules were that Nixon was not spoken to until he wanted to talk. So the two men would sit there for hours on end in silence. B.B. was a bad influence on Nixon in that he was a heavy drinker. We'll get to Nixon's drinking. And very combative, so he was often egging him on some of Nixon's worst judgments. Nixon was on occasion, and this surprised me, there'd been hints of his drinking here and there. He was often out of control. President of the United States, often out of control with these paranoid traits combined. He drank too much. He drank a lot. He didn't hold his liquor very well. On top of that, he took a drug called Dilantin. Dilantin is an anticonvulsive drug. It's not used, it's never been approved for psychiatric purposes. But Jack Dreyfus, the financier, was a great backer of Dilantin. He felt that it took him out of a serious depression. And he even wrote a book about the wonders of Dilantin. And so Nixon, he was waxing on about this to Nixon, and Nixon asked him for some. And Dreyfus says that he said, well, you have to get a prescription from a doctor. And Dreyfus says that Nixon said, the heck with a doctor. I question the word heck, knowing Nixon's language as we do now. Anyway, the combination of Dilantin and alcohol is to enhance the effects of alcohol. So Nixon was not uncommonly, especially at night, but sometimes during the day, he would slur his words, and he would give these strange orders. Walter Isaacson wrote a wonderful book about Kissinger a few years back, and he had a section about these strange phone calls that Nixon would make, often in the middle of the night, rambling, slurring his words, saying, fire Elizabeth Drew. This is the president. Fire Elizabeth Drew. Slam. And then he would call back and say, this is the president. Fire everybody who went to a luncheon speech by Elizabeth Drew. Slam. And then he'd call back and say, this is the president. This order is not appealable. Slam. He did this with large numbers of the State Department that criticized his war policy. He did it with all sorts of people. His aides, not the sorts of people that I think most of us here would entrust our lives with and our safety with, and had to decide all the time whether Nixon was too drunk and they shouldn't carry out the order, or it was just so mad that they should not carry it out. And so you had the likes of Haldeman and John Ehrlichman and Chuck Colson, who thought you never go against the order of a president, deciding whether. Now, I use silly examples, but all of the examples are far from silly. He had a very peculiar governing style. This too surprised me. One thinks of Republicans as well, we've had a little lesson on this, but mainly as running, being competent, in those days, we thought, running competent, well-oiled machines, and everything worked. Nixon was strangely, surprisingly disorganized and indecisive. So his White House did not work as well as we thought that it did. Now let's get to his policies. I have to say that though I'm saying probably almost unmitigated negative things, this book is a fair book and has been recognized as that. But of course it's much more fun to talk about the negative side of it. And it's very important because there has grown up lately, undoubtedly in reaction to the current president, a curious nostalgia for Nixon. And a lot of people, you laugh, but it's true. A lot of people would come up to me and as if it was their own brilliant individual insight, would say, you know, I'm beginning to miss Nixon. This is usually followed by, he was so progressive on domestic policy. So I have a chapter on his domestic policy. Nixon called himself a pragmatist. And on this one, I really think we should take him at his word. He, at the time he governed, he was faced with a large Democratic majority in both chambers and a far more aggressive Democratic Party than exists today. He did sign into law many, many seemingly progressive domestic proposals. Many of them he fought. He vetoed the Clean Air Act, and then finally, you know, it was enacted over his veto. The originators of the environmental proposals were Senators Edmund Muskie and Gaylord Nelson. All of the domestic programs, save one or two important ones, came from Congress, and Nixon accepted that which he thought he had to accept, often with a struggle, trying to cut funds for them, impounding funds. We learned the word impoundment then. As for his environmental policy, for which he gets a lot of teary-eyed credit right now, we learned later, or I learned later, one of the things is to read the memoirs of all these characters, because it's quite interesting. And he virtually turned his domestic policy over to John Ehrlichman. He was not interested in domestic policy in the slightest. He was to be the foreign policy president. And as for the environmental proposals, he said to Ehrlichman that the environmental movement was crap for clowns. Thus his domestic policy. He did propose a radical family assistance plan, which was sort of a basic incomes policy, trotted it out on television. We all thought, wow, this is a radical proposal for a Republican president. Pat Moynihan had talked him into the idea that he was Disraeli, the great conservative reformer British prime minister. And he unveiled this proposal. I looked through Haldeman's diaries. Within 2 weeks of that, or within a week, Nixon said to Haldeman, make a big play for it, but be sure it doesn't pass. We can't afford it. Thus his great domestic policy. A lot of people, the nostalgia that Nixon was so progressive is not only not rooted in fact, but people, Nixon governed in the pre-Reagan era. The great conservative shift, the shift to the right of the Republican Party, hadn't really happened yet, although it can be argued, it can be seen actually, that he started it. He, on race, he had the famous Southern strategy. You appeal to Southerners and blue-collar workers who opposed advancement for blacks. And this was an open and overt appeal to racism by the party of Lincoln. He enforced only those civil rights laws that the courts upheld so that they could say, the Nixon people could say, could blame it on the courts. They didn't do anything beyond what the courts had ordered. On foreign policy, I want to get to the end so you can ask me some questions. On foreign policy, it was a mixture of great triumphs, the opening to China, pursuing and achieving detente with the Soviet Union. It didn't really last past his presidency. Gerald Ford rolled that back quite a bit. But then there was the Vietnam War, which it certainly can be argued went on 5 years longer than was necessary. The deal he ended up with, he could have gotten in 1969. Henry Kissinger has made a career of going around saying, oh, no, they're totally different deals, but they weren't. There was the encouragement of the coup against Salvador Allende, the democratically elected president of Chile, but that ended in the arrival of Augusto Pinochet, who killed God knows how many thousands, maybe a million, I don't know, people. So I would say the foreign policy, for which he is much praised, was quite a mixed picture. Okay, Watergate. Watergate was not an event. It's very misunderstood. It wasn't an event. It wasn't a series of events. It was a mentality that permeated the Nixon presidency from the beginning. I could argue it was a mentality. It was. I'm not arguing. It was a mentality that he brought into the presidency. And the problem was now that the man with all these traits had his hands on the levers of power. He set out to undermine, interfere with the processes of the opposition party. Now again, think of it. You don't just oppose them on the stump, and I know that not pretty things go on in politics. I'm not naive. But this was way over the line. They decided that Nixon really didn't want to run against Muskie. He thought Muskie would be too strong, and he wanted to run against McGovern, whom he was sure he could defeat. I cannot say that their actions led to Muskie's demise. There are suspicions about the Canuck letter that caused Muskie to have tears in the snow in New Hampshire, of which the press made an enormous deal. I never saw why. I don't know, but this was their goal. Now, to me, blocking the effectiveness of the other party, interfering with its activities, is a step on the road to fascism. That's the first thing you do, is you weaken or block the opposition. In his second month in office, really at the end of his first month, in February 1969, Nixon ordered his top aides to set up a secret office within the White House, paid for by outside corporate, therefore illegal funds, to hire gumshoes who would tail Nixon's opponents or enemies. Again, this is another, think of it. And a secret investigative unit within the White House, not to mention paid for illegally. Thus, we had the first great activity was to tail Ted Kennedy, whom at that point looked like he might be Nixon's opponent. Nixon was wont to say he wanted to get the goods on so-and-so and so-and-so. So they wanted to get the goods on Kennedy. After Dan Ellsberg leaked the Pentagon Papers were about the Johnson administration's Vietnam policy, but Nixon feared it would undermine his Vietnam policy. Henry Kissinger was very lathered up, and I learned that that was because Ellsberg had access to the Pentagon Papers, which were locked up at the Rand Corporation, because he was doing a study for Kissinger. So thus, Kissinger had to be more upset than Nixon. This led to the establishment of the Plumbers, who consisted of pretty much a bunch of nutcases. And they were to get the goods on Ellsberg, and then they kept going. To me, and to a lot of people, and even to Nixon, the worst and most frightening thing that the Plumbers did was break into Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office in Beverly Hills. The idea was to get the files on Nixon. I mean, on Ellsberg, excuse me. And the two people who led the Plumbers, Howard Hunt and G. Gordon Liddy, both out of spy novels, Hunt wrote them, Liddy, let's say he was a very eccentric man. They both came out of, as did the four Cubans, Kennedy's failed Bay of Pigs operation. And they were all convinced that the communists were infiltrating the United States through the Democratic Party, and this had to be stopped. Nixon was big on telling people to read his first book. It was to be a memoir called Six Crises. Again, Six Crises, that was his idea of his life. And one of his crises was the Alger Hiss case, which in fact he triumphed. But this was his big crisis. He actually told Ehrlichman to be sure that the Plumbers read Six Crises and read the Hiss chapter. In any event, these gumshoes, one of them, Lydian Hunt cased Dr. Fielding's office, and then they brought out the Cubans, and they managed to get in, and there were no files at all. Not only none on Ellsberg, there were no files. A testimony to their competence. This does not make this out-and-out infringement of the Fourth Amendment right to unwarranted searches and seizures any the less grave just because they botched it. When Nixon was doing the Watergate cover-up, what he was most concerned about was that the Ellsberg psychiatrist's office raid was going to be found out. He understood that this was a very serious matter. As for the Watergate break-ins, the one we know about, the famous one, June 17th, 1973, recently, we celebrated the 35th anniversary of it, was really the fourth attempt of these clowns to get in. In the first attempt, they thought the important thing was to get into the Watergate building, and then they could go upstairs and break into the Democratic National Committee's office. And somehow they ended up being locked in a closet. The second attempt, they got upstairs, but they didn't know how to pick the lock. So one of the burglars went down to Miami to get better lock-picking tools. And they actually got in over the Memorial Day weekend. And the idea, I don't know what the big mystery is, the idea was to get the goods on Larry O'Brien, the committee chairman. I think for two reasons. Nixon wanted to know what was going on. Obviously, you spy on your opposition in this way. And Larry O'Brien had done some work for Howard Hughes, and Nixon was angry because this wasn't public, and his brother's loan from Howard Hughes had been a political problem for him earlier. So they put a tap on O'Brien's phone and on another aide's phone. There are theories about that. They photographed documents, and they left. And Liddy took the material to John Mitchell, the former attorney general, who was now running the reelection committee. And Mitchell looked at the stuff and is alleged to have said, "That's junk." Another word I question. And so he said to Liddy, "Go back and fix the taps. You screwed up the taps." And Liddy said, "Okay." So they went back and were caught. So you see, by the time this happened, it was routine. It was no big deal. Watergate was also a constitutional crisis. The fact that these guys were incompetent made what they were doing no less sinister, and a constitutional crisis because the question arose whether the president would be accountable to the Congress or the courts. And while there's great acclaim of the system worked, it almost didn't. The last chapter, I need to move on, but it turned out to be a period of great fascination to me, which was, it's called The Wizard. It was Nixon's attempt to regain respectability after he was thrown out of office. It was as organized, as relentless as anything he had done in his life. And of course, they had to give it a code name, which was Project Wizard. It was fairly successful among the elites. There is story after story to tell you. If we get time for questions, I hope somebody asks me about the Chinese dinners he gave in New York. There's a lot of looking at Nixon now and saying, but for Watergate, he would have been a great president. He would have been a great foreign policy president, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There are no but-fors in this story because Watergate was a mentality that was omnipresent in this presidency. You cannot excise it. And so there are none. I ended up thinking, and I did not expect to, I just went where the evidence took me, that in the end, Nixon was not fit for the office. He was too tormented. He was too often out of control. He was drunk, taking Dilantin. He made rash decisions. He was drunk on the eve of the invasion of Cambodia. He was up at Camp David with Bibi, and clearly they were drinking their heads off. I think there's a real problem with a president with these problems, with his hands on the ultimate levers of power. There were two worldwide nuclear alerts ordered up. Actually, the second one was by his aides because Nixon was too far gone and in the East Wing. So his aides decided that's what he would like to do. We lived through a psychodrama with Nixon. And in many ways, no one was more revealing about Nixon than Nixon. There was a quote I was hoping to have time to read you, where he actually explains his life in a startlingly revealing way, and what got him started and what got him in the end. The one thing that can be said about Richard Nixon, though, is not just that he was this fascinatingly complex figure, he was never boring, and he still isn't. Thank you. Where's my minder? What can we do? Can I take a couple of questions? I hope one of them's about Chinese dinners.
Tell us about the Chinese dinner.
Oh! After Nixon was out of office, he was living in San Clemente, and he decided that it was too confining, that the way to restore himself to respectability was to be on the fast track, where the action was. So he moved to New York, he moved into a brownstone, right behind Arthur Schlesinger's, who Arthur commented, "There goes the neighborhood." So one way he worked on the respectability was about every week he would hold a dinner of movers and shakers, whether it was publishers, bankers, business people. Sometimes there was a topic. One time he had a Shakespeare expert in. 7 o'clock on the dot, he awkwardly met people in the foyer. They'd then go up to the library where Nixon would mix drinks. Now, Nixon's house, in case anybody forgot his great triumph, was done out in Chinese decor. His faithful valet, Manolo Sanchez, was gone, and all the servants were Chinese. And he would serve this excellent Chinese food, and there would be a discussion around the table. They were always stag because the language was so blue that Nixon didn't think women should be there. And then they would adjourn for coffee and talk some more. At 10:30 on the dot, he would look at a clock, and he'd look for the most upright person in the room, upright man in the room. Let's say it's Nick Goldsboro here, because I know he's very upright. And he would look at the clock, and he would say, "Well, we have to stop now. I promised to get Nick to a house of prostitution by 11. One more, and then we have to sign books and go off to hear Bill Clinton. Yeah. Go ahead. Oh, I'm glad you asked that. It was, happy at first, but it evolved into a non-marriage. And they lived separately at the White House, and he wrote memos to his wife saying, to Mrs. Nixon from the president. But oddly in all of this, a great exception was his daughters really loved him. They remain passionately, especially Julie, defending of him. So something happened there, though he didn't have a lot of time for his family when he was in the White House. Something happened that he grew close to his daughters. Maybe it was more after the White House, and of course it was their daddy, and he was being put through all this. So that was the exception. I'm afraid we have to stop now. You can ask me. Thank you.